This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. I'm Dan Clark. On this very strange week, I'm sure we're all feeling slightly weird about the fact that the soon-to-be most powerful man in the free world is a unqualified reality TV star. But hey, doesn't matter. At least he's got some good policies and opinions. Oh, nope, he doesn't have those either. Yes, I'm talking about Trump. My theory is that he may not be quite as bad as we all thought, but just because I think it was all rhetoric, but I think that's just me being really, really hopeful that the theatrics is over and maybe there'll be some, you know, sort of diplomacy, hopefully, please. Otherwise, it will be the end of the world. Anyway, I'll try and bring some entertainment on a week when we definitely need it. I've got a bumper show this week. I've got two sets of two guests, both incredibly talented sets of writers and creators of very big shows at the moment. We've actually got like the big shows of the moment on our show. So later on we'll be talking to Jonathan Brackley and Sam Vincent, who are the creators of Humans. But right now, my first guests joining me are two incredibly talented writers. I've worked with them many years ago, I think about 10 years ago. They'd been comedy writers for years, and then decided to give drama a go, only to land a ginormous hit on BBC One on their first go. Not at all jealous. they're the creative minds behind The Missing, which I'm currently hooked on. They've recently had success with One of Us on BBC One as well. They're about to have a show out on ITV. They were also the exec producers of the most talked about comedy this year, Fleabag. I'm talking, of course, about the writers and brothers, which is a first on this show, Jack and Harry Williams. Hello, boys.
Hello.
Could you say your name? Boy, singular. Could you say your name so people know who's who?
I'm Jack.
And I'm Harry.
Is that a do we sound different?
I've got a bit of a lisp going on.
Oh yeah. And Jack,
what have I got?
Jack, sounds
and
like
Harry sounds a bit more broken.
Dirty.
I sound naughty.
You sound like you did a bit.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, congratulations on The Missing series
Thank you.
Two.
Thank
is
you
it
very much.
Is it going well? I just said in my intro that I am completely and utterly hooked on this.
Thank you. That's very kindly to say. Is it going well? Yeah, I think it is.
How are you gauging it? Is it just numbers? Is it reviews? Is it what your friends are saying?
It's a bit of everything. Yeah, it's.
Do you go up to people in the street and go, "Have you seen The Missing? What do you think?"
Yeah. I'm actually one step away from that. I think I dropped my daughter off at school and her teacher said, "Oh, I saw your show." And that was good. When people grab you,
I was looking out, I was looking around.
Did you hit her and say, "Don't talk to me"?
Did you like it? Oh, thanks so much. Thank you.
I was looking around our new house and the estate agent who sold it to us went, "Oh, you mentioned you were a freelance writer last time we spoke." I was like, "I don't think I did that." And then he's like, "You wrote The Missing. I'm hooked." So which was a good thing.
And also, before that, you thought it was a good... Yeah.
I didn't like him before. I really didn't like him. He was one of the worst kind of estate agents. After that, I thought, this guy's smart. He's together.
He's not like the
rest
of them.
He knows what he's doing.
He's brilliant
at his job.
Show me that bathroom again.
But does that mean he's been doing some serious Googling of you?
Yeah, I don't know what he's been doing.
Definitely, because you hadn't said what you wrote.
I hadn't said it.
You said you were writing. He had really
got down. That's weird. That means that he Googles people, even if... Not because
he's like... He Googles everyone. He's a Googleman.
He's a Googleman.
Only people he wants to fuck.
Yeah. He's Stephen Googleman. German, maybe. Yeah. So it's going good. Because the first series went like amazingly, right?
I like that.
That's good.
Yeah, well,
Let's say that about the second, because why not? It's good. It seems to be. The figures are good.
Yeah.
The reviews are good.
I just say, I think I like it even more than the first series, and I was a big fan.
Damn.
Yeah. I love you.
No, honestly.
I have seen that quite a lot. I do read absolutely everything online. And there's been a few things going. Season 2, better than season 1. I agree.
Yeah.
It's really nice. It's massive, lovely. We really thought we were going to shit the bed, to be honest.
It's really terrifying when it goes well the first time around, because you're like, oh shit, they're going to find us out now and they're going to realise we're actually just fuckwits.
See, isn't it funny how writers, every writer you speak to, they always, well actually everyone in every part of the business feels like they're going to be found out.
Oh, totally.
But I think you've written a really clever... dense, sophisticated show, and yet to hear you going, oh God, they're going to find us out or shit the bed, which, by the way, I never know if that's a good or a bad thing.
Yes. Depends on your... It means you've had a good night.
Depends on how much you like shit in the bed.
Yeah. The rest of your day,
I mean, in some people, that's a definite requirement.
They would like it, yeah.
But to hear you say those things, it's like, oh, okay, so even something that appears as confident as that show is written by people that are doubting themselves
constantly,
all the time.
Yeah, yeah, because you never know how you do it. You just try and do the best you can.
How do you deal with that? That's one thing I'm always interested in with writers, because it can be solitary. Obviously, you've got each other.
We always have each other.
We have each other.
Which is probably a blessing and a curse, right?
Mainly a blessing, I'm going to say, definitely. Because when there's two of you, you can just go, is it all right? Are they going to hate us? You can share the load of anxiety and neuroticism.
But then when it's bad, and there have been bad ones, you do just sit there for days going, and then they said this, and you're just looking at each other sort of lost and scared. And
but at least you've got each other to
look. At least we have each other to, but you egg each other on for the sort of misery chat.
And I do read everything, so I managed to find some obscure commentator somewhere that's going, I see it's the worst thing. I read it to Harry.
He does.
Which one of you is better at dealing with any sort of negativity?
Me, Harry.
Are you?
Yeah. Because I just ignore it and I'm like, fuck it, I can't.
Exactly. Is it because you dream more?
Egotist, yeah, exactly.
He's a rampant narcissist. Thinks, oh, well, that can't be true.
Yeah, thanks.
See, I always believe bad reviews about myself and not good ones.
Yeah.
Like good ones, I go, I mean, it's nice they've said that, but I think they've got me wrong.
You need like 50 good ones, and one bad one is equivalent to about 50, I think. Yeah.
But you do it to yourself. Like, I will try and actively avoid reviews for a certain amount of time, but you'll go, well, I'm not going to read anything, and you'll wake up like in a sea of TV Choice magazines, like covered in Look and Grazia.
What happened?
And like, yeah.
I love that you're only going for a very specific type of review there.
It's only weekly.
You've ignored all the broadsheets.
Only weekly. That's where the people speak.
See, one of the luxuries of having a hit series and getting a second series, even if it's not a hit, the first one, I'm speaking from experience, but knowing that you've got another chance at it is A, you get to iron out some of the issues you had in the first series, but really importantly is you've got the cast in your head. You can hear the way they speak, you can write the character for those actors, but you went and got rid of 99% of your cast.
Such a bad idea.
It was a fucking terrible idea, because it's a brand new show. You know,
why did you do that? Was it because you felt the story had just tied up?
When we pitched the story and started writing, we always said Jimmy Nesbitt's character that ends, and we had quite a definitive conclusion in mind, and we did.
Well, it wasn't that definitive, was it?
In our minds, it was. We were like, the best endings are cyclical, you know, for us. The OC, of course. It is a great ending, I've got to say. It is a great ending.
Brilliant reference. I saw a lot of the OC in the first series of The Missing.
And did you see the ending? The ending's fantastic.
He meets the young Ryan.
And in this one, we're like, look, the first scene of the whole thing is him coming in going, I found something really drunk and weird and lost. And we thought, if the last thing is, once he's been on this journey, he's got all this evidence that suggests that he probably did die and all this stuff, and he's still convinced because he can't that he is out there, because he can't live in a world without the possibility that his son's in it. We're like, that'd be a cool ending, because it's set, the audience are in the mind of this protagonist, and he's lost and, you know, doesn't know where to look.
I know, but it did also feel like what you were doing is teeing up season two a bit.
That was my father-in-law
called up about that. I love the cliffhanger, and I was like, oh shit. Well, there are a few lingering shots we did take issue with. There's a long lingering shot of the boy at the end of the episode, which heavily implies he is his son, which I tried repeatedly to get rid of and failed.
But the picture in the newspaper Ollie might look like 15 years later, then they cast the boy who might be on him, was fucking like the same guy.
There were a few sneaky things which were messed with people, which we wouldn't have put
but
in.
But you definitely felt like that story had finished.
It was meant to.
Definitely. He's so dead.
Okay, spoiler.
If you haven't seen it, sorry, we've totally ruined it for you.
So then series two, how do you like prepare to come up with something that you feel is equally... Do you just go somewhere completely different?
Panic. It took us months. I mean, we did spend at least a month trying to work out how to bring James Nesbitt's character back, because
might work. Yeah, exactly. But
and even if it wasn't for the search for his son, what did we have? He was like looking for missing people generally. Sorry, maybe
we looked into some options, but I think we were like, look, when you have a missing person, we had talked about that so much and followed all the routes that could take, and we're like, we're just going to end up telling the same fucking story again, you know.
But you're tied to this damn title.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. The missus.
Yeah. But that was a brilliant idea to have it based on someone coming back.
Yeah, well, good.
At what point did you go, oh, I think I've got a
that
spin on it?
That was the first thing.
Was it?
Yeah, I think that's when we decided to write it, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Actually, at the point in which we decided that his son had to be dead in season one, we had been talking about all the endings, and if he's alive, if he finds him at the end, that's not that happy, because what the hell's happened to him? But then we realised there's quite a good story in that. And
there's a line in the car between Chucky and Jimmy at the end of the first series where he's going, you know, Jimmy's like, oh, I wish he was still here. And he goes, well, what if he had survived? He'd been locked in a basement the last 8 years. What kind of a life is that? And we're like, well, actually, that's a story in itself.
Yeah.
What happens when that person comes back? And so where were they? What does that mean?
But you know, it definitely felt like a cool story.
Yeah.
For another child.
Like I said, I think you've done a brilliant job. Do you, when you write, because I've never written anything that's like a thriller or, you know, that has those kinds of multiple strands going on. Do you write the story before you write the script? Do you?
Yeah.
Because there are times when I'm watching, because I know you, there are times where I'm watching it and you have this amazing, you're so good at cliffhangers.
Thank you.
That I go, you should work on EastEnders. the drum roll would work really well with your material. The music, by the way, in the show is excellent as
well. Dominic Shearer.
Really amazing, beautiful. But I there are times where a new revelation happens and I'm like, I can just imagine you two going yes, high-fiving, going, that's such a brilliant idea. And then 2 minutes later going, shit, how are we going to unravel this? This is so difficult.
That is exactly
it.
Because you get an amazing moment and you go, fuck, that's good. And sometimes you'll get an amazing moment and you'll realise, fuck, you can never make that work.
Really?
It's like the I Don't Have a Phone sitcom thing from that Rob Lott, you know.
Yeah, Conversations with My Agent. Have you heard that book?
No.
It's
what's it called?
Conversations with My Agent by Rob Lott.
Oh, I have heard of that. Yeah.
It's, you know how multicams, you know, studio shows, they go, they gather in a little huddle to try and find the best punchline for a joke or whatever, and they go, there's a phone ringing and someone goes, it's like,
they're trying to find a punchline to someone, so and so called you, and someone always pitches the line, yeah, how did that happen? I don't have a phone. And like, it's sort of, if the absurd thing gets a laugh because you go,
yeah, there's
how
a phone
that
ringing.
Possible? Isn't that hilarious?
There's but a phone actually, ringing, isn't that weird? Why?
Because I don't have a phone.
Yeah. Which is funny, but it doesn't make any sense, and you never can make it. So,
how you retrospectively.
Same thing.
Same thing in drama. So, have you had a couple of like ideas, twists, where you've tried to work backwards? And you've just gone, no, this is never going to...
A few. Yeah. I've got to say, when the moment's good enough, you always think, we've got to make that work. I'm the end of episode one of this series.
Does that mean when you have a revelation, do you then have to like do a backstory building up to that moment to make sure that it kind of trusts?
Sometimes it'll give you story. You know, you'll go, oh, well, if we can make that work, then maybe they could be doing that. And you're like, it opens up a whole other avenue. So it's just part of the process in terms of cracking the story.
Comes from the end of episode one. The moment that came, we had to work out an entire...
Really?
Arc to make that.
You had to
work.
Come up with a whole. You had to scrap everything.
Yeah.
This is better.
Yeah.
Do you ever write with just a blank page, or is it always pretty much prepped the story?
Always
structured.
Always. I hate blank pages. I
know what it's about. Yeah.
I once saw an interview with Paul Abbott when he was talking about writing State of Play. I don't know if you've seen State of Play, the BBC, not the film, and which I thought was. Amazing.
Yeah,
and then thinking that every writer maps out what their story is, he said all he knew is he wanted to write about politics and the media, and he just started writing on a blank page. And I'm like, I hate you so much.
Who do you think you are?
No, who do you think you are?
How dare you?
So you
get that BAFTA back.
I know, Give us that BAFTA back for being good.
You didn't earn it.
Yeah.
How dare you?
So you guys started in comedy, right?
We did.
That's
the loosest possible sense of the word.
But that's how we know each other. It's fair to say that you'd had maybe trouble getting a show that really stuck. Well, I don't want to be rude, but you had shows that I really liked, by the way. One of them is Roman's Empire, which is, I think, when I met you, and Full English, I really liked.
Thank you.
But they... But, you know, there was a time where it was like, guys, you know, when you just need that break. And now it seems like you're getting breaks every other week. It's like they're coming out of every orifice.
Calmer, hopefully.
We spent 8 years.
Worse than dog shit from The Guardian.
That was the first ever review we had, the first ever show we'd had. You know, it's like 10 years ago, I was 26.
Yeah.
First show, BBC Two, and you go, oh my God, the paper's going to review my show.
Yeah.
Gareth McLean in The Guardian, he now storylines for Coronation Street, so fuck him.
He's not bitter. That's what's nice about you, Jack. You're not bitter.
This show.
You don't hold any resentment for anything.
He compared us to our dad, who's also a writer, and said, they're worse than him or something.
Yeah, they brought a dad into it. From BAFTA winning Nigel Williams. The sons have inherited none of his talent.
Yeah. Oh. Their show is worse than dog shit. Yeah. Go, wow, all right.
Did that hurt?
Yeah.
No, I'm fine with it. Can't you tell?
Clearly.
It hurt. I can't remember.
My dad was delighted. He was like, well, I mean, obviously, I'm very talented.
Your dad was like, thank fuck he didn't say they were better than me.
I do have an Emmy.
I'm glad that he got my email. The reason I would say that and bring that up is not just to remind you of the tough times, it's to inspire people that, you know, sometimes these things take a while and to see, like, you've got The Missing, which is currently on, you had One of Us on BBC One just recently, you're about to start a new show, Liar, that's right, on ITV.
Another show for BBC One called Relic, which is their thriller.
Yeah. Relic?
Yeah.
Oh my God. You know, keeping your fingers in the comedy pies, you exact probably the most talked about comedy show this year, Fleabag.
Yes.
You know, I don't know, how involved with that were you?
That was, I'm quite very involved. I mean, because it's gone back a long way. We first met Phoebe about 3 or 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. before she had written the play, actually. So she had just written the first few lines of the monologue, and we're just having a drink with her and trying to meet new talent, and she read the first few lines and we're like, fuck, we want that, let's make that, let's do a TV show of that. And
based on a couple of lines.
drunk
of dialogue. Let's just be clear, it was a monologue, but it was only a monologue.
I was going to say
that's how you do business. The Trump way of
the way forward, the future.
And then in the interim she went and wrote the play as we were developing the TV show, and so that sort of made it a lot easier to sort of help sell that to channels and all that stuff.
So were you there when, so were you kind of attached to the play as well?
Yeah, we were developing the TV show before the play.
So theatre and tandem. Edinburgh and stuff?
Yeah, we did it sort of at the same time. So we've been trying to crack the TV show for so long that she ended up writing the play because she was getting so frustrated with
us
and the structure and how you put that down. And then the play unlocked a lot of things.
So were you were quite hands-on for a while?
Yeah, because I think having made so much comedy and seen where it can go wrong, I think just sometimes people just lose nerve, and you can't make that stuff by committee. You know, she knew what she wanted to do.
Yeah,
that's a very authored show, isn't it?
It's so authored, and she writes so much stuff. I mean, the thing with her is, like, she makes so much stuff, and then she's like, oh, actually, no, I'm going to change it. You're like, no, what you had written was so fucking amazing. Really? Let's keep that. That was our only job, really.
Our biggest contribution was reminding her when she had something brilliant and making sure no one else fucked with it.
Making it look really good. That was the main thing.
How do you stop people from fucking with it?
Just say, this is really good. Don't fuck with it. And you back her up when you need to, and you have to trust that it'll be good, and you have to trust.
Do you not worry about saying that to commissioners and
we don't say that, obviously.
So you're absolutely right. We'll pass on the notes.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Fortunately, we see they're very nice. So that's okay.
Well, do you guys want to continue writing comedy yourselves?
No,
I don't know.
We tried for 8 years and failed.
Yeah,
I don't know if you failed. It's just so difficult to get even good comedy sort of can hover around and not like just hit the whatever it is that makes it go more mainstream or something.
You're right.
And it is. And the thing about comedy is it's really stressful. It's really hard when you're telling jokes and you're putting stuff out there and people aren't laughing. That's a really very stressful thing. And I think that's the main reason.
My next question, which is, which do you prefer writing?
Comedy is so much harder, I think.
I said this to someone in a meeting the other day, and I think it's true. Most people I know who work in comedy are, to some degree, depressed.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. And I don't think they were depressed people before they got in the business.
It's a constant search for other people's approval.
Yeah,
it's just.
And do you not? So you don't have that in drama.
I do, but it's just, I have it constantly, actually. But at least it's not pronounced, because when it's, a joke doesn't land, you know straight away. If people don't like a drama, they tend to be like, oh, I don't like it that much.
Yeah.
They're not vitriolic. The response to a comedy people don't like is absolutely insane, isn't it? You get people going, this is shit, how dare you, shouldn't be allowed to work.
Yeah, a joke that falls flat is so much more painful than a scene that doesn't quite work, where you're just like, that was on.
Yeah. do you, when you're writing drama, do you often, how do you sort of test whether it's, because often with comedy you can sort of test, but how do you know, what's the litmus test, whether it's dramatic enough?
I think
or
each other, really, if we can surprise each other and
make each other cry.
Holding each other.
That'll really move you.
I think you know when you've got the story, the bones of a story, and you're like, oh, fuck, that's there's an amazing scene in that. The story's led you to a point where this scene can happen, and we're both itching to write that scene. You're like, that's a, it's definitely going to be a good
when there's a scene, we're going to have to tell each other what they think, and they have to go, and the detective is saying, we're going over here. You know that's not good. If there's a scene, you're going, oh, my God, by the end of this, their expectations of each other is completely reversed.
Yeah.
We're fighting over who gets to write it.
What's the miss in the first drama you wrote?
It was. I wrote a lot of drama on my own for sort of series TV.
Yeah. What, like writing episodes
like
for Hire?
Yeah. I watched some Wild at Heart.
Wonderful shows.
Wonderful shows. Wild at Heart, of course. You may see my episode with the giraffe. Mm-hmm. It was poorly. It was quite something.
It's very, very authored,
it
that
was
episode.
Very authored episode.
I saw
very
that
powerful.
And I went, giraffes? That must
it
be.
It must be. Yeah, that's what I meant. But that was the first original drama we ever wrote.
It was.
It's not bad, is it? Hit rate?
Shit, yeah, good. Thank God.
Well, we're nearly going to stop. Well, we're going to have to stop writing at some point together if nothing is sticking.
We only wrote it. We hadn't worked for about 6 months and we were completely broke. So,
So how do you, what is your process? Do you like do proper office hours when you write? Do you just do it when the muse hits you? Like, do you drink? Like, what's the.
Well, actually, these days, because we're producing more, it's sort of finding the time to write and setting whole days aside where, you know, we don't have meetings so we can actually just sit and write is the thing. Because we've been trying to do, like, 2 hours here and there, but that never fucking works because you just sit there.
Yeah, I know.
Gassing.
You do. If you go and you have an app. But, yeah, if you set aside a day and just have a chat, it's a nice change from talking about production schedules and thrilling things like
thrilling
that.
Things. Was your dad a drama or he was a drama writer, right?
Yeah, he does everything really. Drama, he
plays, books.
Plays books, journalism, adaptations.
Of course, I remember his article on. Should I? Should I know him? Am I being a philistine for not knowing his work?
No.
Was he?
No. He's
just the most famous writer ever.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you were growing up, were you inspired? Like, what? How come you both became writers? Like, what was it? What was the thing that was passed down? Was it because he was like, I want you to be writers as well?
Yes,
or
he'd beat us
it?
If we didn't come up with a good act two.
What kind of environment was it that you, like, was it a
I think, to
artistic?
Be honest, principally it started with, when you're growing up, most people's pet dads are off at work and travel a lot, and he was normally at home, or when he wasn't, he was at the bar.
Yeah.
And I thought, that looks quite fun. I want his job. And then he told me a lot of stories.
The being in the bar bit.
Yeah, the being in the bar bit.
I want that job.
Yeah. You go, that's quite cool.
I think, and my mum's a producer, so around the table, you'll sort of naturally talk about stories and in a way that doesn't seem weird, you know, so it becomes sort of normal to do that. It was just sort of depressingly predictable, isn't it?
Well,
he's a writer, she's a producer, we all it's sort of a natural thing, you know.
I don't know if I know anyone other than you. I know of people, or I may have met people, but not people I know who grew up with, who've ended up doing exactly what their parents did, or certainly
it is unusual.
I think
it is unusual.
There's a lot of actors at the moment in their 30s who seem to be the sons or 20s.
There are a lot of them, aren't there?
There's quite a lot. There's like a Fox and a there's obviously Rafe Spall. There's an Alan.
What else is there? What else have we got?
Can we get a list of famous sons? There's a few that I was quite surprised that they were also. Anyway, before I get bitter about people and their.
Phil Collins isn't an actor.
No. Does he never acted?
Yeah, of course he's acted.
He has acted, hasn't he?
I would call him an actor before a musician. I think his work in Buster was overshadows his many hits in the pop world.
Amazing.
Apparently, he grew up as in a, not grew up in a that would be weird in a he went to state school. He was born in a stage school. And
born in a stage school and
raised in by a drama teacher.
Amazing.
Yeah. He's back, but slightly, there's something not. Anyway, I don't know what they're talking about.
You're not feeling
He seems frail. I'm a bit worried about.
Well, he was really depressed, wasn't he?
Yeah,
and he was like, I can't do music anymore because people think I'm a joke, didn't he? It was quite a sort of...
Well, didn't... Yeah.
I felt a bit bad for him.
He stopped. Yeah. I don't feel too bad. He's doing fine.
He was a classic sort of like, you know, the way that people are about Coldplay or Ed Sheeran now or something.
Yeah.
He was the butt of a joke back in the day, which is weird when you're that successful... To be so bothered by,
because
you're like, people are buying my record, and this was in an age where you had to go to a shop to buy a record,
millions of people sold. I know they don't like me enough.
Yeah, chill out, Phil. So you've got Liar, you can't really talk about it. You want to keep that under wraps.
There's a few things under wraps, but there'll be exciting announcements to come.
It's with Joanne Froggatt and Johan Grifford are the leads.
Okay.
Mr. Fantastic.
Good.
Yes, of course.
A lovely man.
We're talking the Fantastic Four films.
No, he's just Fantastic. That's what he insists you call him on set, is it?
Yeah. Mr. Fantastic, that was a great great take. But could we get a bit more and then will Fleabag happen again? I mean, it feels like a show that could or couldn't. Like it's
definitely in the offing, I think.
People were talking.
If and when Phoebe's ready.
I think she threw everything into it and she needs a little break. Yeah. And I think it needs to be... It's one of those shows that she wants to do it right rather than... Mm-hmm. Got to get it in for next year, you know, so...
And are you working with other comedy people to develop shows as well?
Yeah, they've got a few things going.
Do you enjoy doing that?
I love it.
Do you?
Yeah.
It's great.
What do you like about it?
Well, I think we sort of got a bit of ADD because during the years of doing the comedy, we're always constantly having to pitch things and come up with new ideas, and it's sort of now in our nature to... go, oh, what's that, and get distracted and try and pursue something else when we really should be doing the thing we're being paid to do. So,
talking of pitching, when you first started pitching drama, having been known in the industry as comedy writers, did people take you seriously when you first did that?
We actually wrote the script for The Missing.
Did you?
Just on spec, because we knew no one would take us seriously, so we went away to France and wrote it, and then sent it only to our agent, saying this might be really embarrassing, like it's the kind of poetry you write when you're 16, and said, if it's awful, don't tell anyone, we're really sorry.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of crying and emotion and stage directions and people...
Isn't that what they want, though?
Yeah. Well, it turns out they do like it.
Yeah. We still don't develop, really.
There's not quite as much crying in this season, is there?
There isn't as much crying.
No, it's a bit more withheld. There's a bit more like, what's going...
A bit less crying, a bit more shouting, I would say.
A bit more shouting. Really? There's a lot of crying to come.
There's a fair bit of crying.
Six and eight.
I haven't seen this week's yet. I'm very excited.
Oh, the end of this week.
Is
very
great.
Yeah. I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
There's a lot. I don't want to just keep talking about that show because you
obviously have to talk about that show.
Yeah.
How did One of Us do?
I think it did fine.
It did.
Some nice reviews.
Yeah,
didn't it?
It did well. You know, it went out in August. Four parties. It's not the same level of engagement, I think, but that's okay. I think it was a bit more of a strange prospect, if that's the fair thing to say. It's a harder ask for an audience to you know, get into a show.
How do you explain that show in a sort of pithy...
The problem with that show is, the premise is that issue. I think that's the main problem with it. It's not a simple way in. It's sort of this morality tale, and it's an ensemble show, so there's no clear sort of way in for an audience, where with The Missing you're like, guy loses kid, guy looks for kid. It's quite simple.
Yeah.
And then you can really hook into that. With this one's a bit more... involved as a premise.
And what do you have to pick the person you like, sort of thing? That, like, there's no clear lead actor.
Yeah,
or
yeah, like that would have helped to have a clear lead.
It would have. You're sort of suspecting everyone.
I think you should have come to me, guys. I would have given you that note straight away.
That said, I mean, it's a great show and it looks good and it did well. It's just
We're proud of it. But
yeah,
you know,
it's good to, you know, it's good when you get to a point in your life where you can be a bit more philosophical about the, you know, successes of your shows rather than just everything crippling you and you crying into your pillow at night.
It did for so long, I think. It's just exhausting.
Yeah,
that's what he says. It's not, there's nothing negative about that at all.
Yeah.
And I think just, it's good to look at things and go, what could we have done differently or better?
Yeah, because after The Missing, you go, why aren't they doing what The Missing did?
That had a certain level of...
Well, that's a bit greedy.
Yeah,
I want everything I do to be a big hit.
That's the trouble, And then compared to that,
exactly.
Do you have plans to do a third Missing?
I think, again, like with the second one, I think it would have to be really different and not go over the same...
Or really well-paid.
Well,
that always helps.
That always helps. And I think we need some time off because it's been two years non-stop.
Yeah.
I think the good thing about this one is that people haven't gone, oh God, they're doing it again. Oh, it's rubbish. And that's been lovely. But I think that's because we took the time to make sure it was.
Also, the anthology aspect of it, which is weird because there was a time, I remember when people would pitch any kind of show, whether comedy or drama, where it would be different stories each week or different sets of character each season.
Yeah.
And now it seems like quite a lot of shows are doing that. It's sort of fashionable again.
It's weird, isn't it? I know. Suddenly it's allowed. It also means there's no schedule of it has to be every year or every 2 years. It's sort of like if we had a really good idea we're excited about and that was 3 or 4 years' time, great. But I don't...
I think it's sort of the good thing about it is you probably could do it in a couple of years with a whole new set of...
So, yeah. 2 or 3 years. And also, I think the one thing we do want to write for Checky again because you just love him as a character.
Yeah, he's great. It's great.
It'd be a shame.
It's a shame not to, but I wouldn't... Yeah,
what's
we don't
his,
have
What's
idea.
His history? What's his, like...
He's done everything. He was like in Bad Boys as sort of the was evil he? Frenchman. Yeah, and the Patriot.
The Patriot, the so evil Frenchman.
So he was
Frenchman.
The sort of 90s... He was the 90s Frenchman.
Yeah.
Evil Frenchman on the whole, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Always evil. And he's a musician as well.
He's just done a movie with Joaquin Phoenix. He just does what he feels like. He's great. He's the nicest man.
Yeah,
brilliant. Yeah,
oh, I was pleased that he came back. That's
for sure. Us too.
He's going to have quite a lot of trauma if someone goes missing a third time, though, isn't he?
If it's from an old case that he didn't solve, you'll start to go, dude.
Yeah.
Maybe
you
you're not good at this.
You have a reputation for being the world's best detective, yet you keep not finding them. So that would be an issue.
If you want a guy who won't find your kid, here's your man.
Give it 17 years. Yeah, he might come up with a vague idea.
That's his superpower.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, well, look, guys, thanks for coming in. It's been a pleasure.
It's been our pleasure, Daniel.
No, it's mine.
No. It's been ours.
I don't know what I was about to say there.
Please go. We can do that.
Okay. Just keep up the good work because I'm a fan and I hope that the next thing, The Liar, when will that be out?
Probably not till next September, I thought.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
quite a while.
Good luck with the rest of this season.
Brilliant.
Don't tell me anything.
I'll tell you nothing.
Thank you very much, Jack and Harry. Okay, well, before we bring on our next guests, the creators of Humans, I'm going to play us a little song. We play songs on this show from TV shows or films. And if you listen to this as a podcast, you'll only ever hear like a 5-second clip. That's because of rights and stuff. So tune in to foobar.com on Fridays at 12 p.m. if you want to hear the show with the full songs. And if you do listen to this as a podcast, please rate the show and subscribe and share it with all your friends. So this is a song from the film The Wrestler. The song called The Wrestler, and it's from the almighty Bruce Springsteen, The Boss, with The Wrestler.
Have you ever seen a one-trick pony and feel so happy and free? If you've ever seen a one-trick pony, then you've seen me. Have you ever seen a one-legged dog making his way down the street? If you've ever seen a one-legged dog, then you've seen me. Then you've seen me. I come and stand at every door. And you've seen me. I always leave with less than I had before. And you've seen me. But I can make you smile when the blood it hits the floor. Tell me, friend, can you ask for anything more? Tell me, can you ask for anything more? Have you ever seen a scarecrow filled with nothing but dust and weeds? If you ever seen that scarecrow, then you've seen me. Have you ever seen a one-eyed
man? Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
So, my guests today are the creative minds behind Channel 4's smash hit show Humans, and the second series is currently airing on Channel 4 on Sunday nights. We have with us Jonathan Brackley and Sam Vincent. Sam Vincent?
Vincent.
I think you're wearing a rolled up polo neck and smoking a cigarette, so I feel like you should be. Could you just say your names so that the listeners can identify who is who?
Unfortunately, we have very similar sounding voices, but
so
I'm
could
John
one of you
Brackley,
do an accent?
Yeah, and Sam will speak in a Welsh accent.
Hello. So you're John, say hello.
John. Hi.
I think John is slightly more well-spoken than I am, just by shape.
Yeah, I think so as well. Is that okay? And did I get the order right? Jonathan Brackley and Sam Vincent?
That's how we legally have to be addressed, yeah.
Is it? Is that
that order?
Surname alphabetical, is that what it is?
Oh, yes.
Always.
Oh, absolutely.
What happens if someone says it the other way around? Do you have to correct
them? The lawyers are waiting in the lobby.
we split up.
Is that who your people are in the
all 16
there?
Of them. Yeah. They've got a lot of legal power behind them.
No, that's our nutritionist.
What, that's 16 people?
Cordelia.
Yeah, they do. They're constantly taking blood tests and urine samples every hour on the hour. Have you ever seen a nutritionist? This is totally off topic, but
visited one or in the street?
No, probably, like gone into a professional nutritionist.
I've never done that.
Yeah,
no.
Okay, good.
Sorry. Kill that question. Dead.
Have you?
Was
that your first question?
It wasn't. I just thought of that then. Well, thanks for joining us, guys. And congratulations on the show and the success of the show. Someone told me this. Thank I don't you. Know if this is true or not, that last year when the show was on, Humans, it was Channel 4's biggest drama for several years. Is that correct?
20 years.
Yes. 20 years.
Not since the Chamomile Lawn.
You know, that show we all remember.
Yeah. Which I'm sure you recall fondly. It's their biggest original drama launch ever.
That's amazing.
It's pretty astonishing.
I mean, we knew that was going to happen, didn't we?
Oh, definitely, yeah. No. We wrote it specifically to be the best thing ever.
Okay.
We wouldn't have bothered.
I admire that confidence. I sort of detect a little bit of bullshit, but...
There's a lot of bullshit there. We obviously had no idea it was going to do that, and I don't think anybody did.
Did you, when you wrote the first series, you didn't know that, so then the second series, you have suddenly expectations or pressure? Did it feel in any way different writing it a second time round?
Do you know what? We've had that question before, and the it's quite thought-provoking. The honest answer is no.
Really?
It doesn't put any extra pressure on because we, without which does sound too sort of sanctimonious, we're already trying to make the best show that we can.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really change anything. We're still trying to make the best show. We were first year.
You don't sit down for the second
year
series and think, okay, this one I'm going to try 20% harder to be better than the last year. You just put your all into it and fingers crossed.
Also don't, so you know, it's completely fruitless to try and forensically work out why it was successful and then just do the bits that made it successful. That's insanity as well. So it actually doesn't change your approach and it doesn't really heap any pressure on. The pressure was there anyway.
There is an element of writing a second series from my experience where it's easier because suddenly you've actually got the actors' voices in your head and you go, I know how to write this person. I can hear them.
Exactly. And the second series, we very much know what the show is. You know, we're comfortable with it. You know, there was a lot of, you know, establishing work going on in the first series to try and sort of find the show's voice. We do. There's a certain sort of comfort level in a second series.
Can you describe in a in an economical fashion the premise of the show? And I only say economic. You can give me a long version if you want, but I always think, like, what's the one-liner of the show?
So Humans takes place in a parallel present where humanoid lifelike androids known as synths are commonplace throughout the world, particularly in all areas of menial and domestic labour. Hundreds of millions of these things. They look just like us. They're incredibly advanced, but they are unconscious automatons, apart from the fact that very few have actually achieved self-awareness. Mm-hmm. And the second series sees that branch of the storyline expanding.
Are you surprised? Did you know that, and again, I hate to bring this up, I'm sure you've been asked this as well, that AI seems to be kind of in vogue again? It has been maybe, you know, in the past, but obviously the obvious show I'm talking about is Westworld. They're very different shows, which I think is so brilliant, is that you've got two prominent shows at the moment, and yet somehow they feel a million miles apart from each other.
Well, I think the subject matter is sort of in the ether. You know, when we were making the first series, you know, every day pretty much there'd be a story in the press about, you know, moving forward of artificial intelligence. And I think that's because we're, you know, now sort of closer than ever before to it happening. It's still, you know, a fair way away, according to most experts, but, you know, it's nearer than we could possibly have imagined. And, you know, we've got people like Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking are saying, you know, it's the next great existential threat to humanity.
Do you believe that? I do. I'm terrified of it. He's going to give a shit.
It's all good. It's all going to be fine. We've done our research.
Yeah.
You know, TV writers say it's okay. Not the really smart scientists, what kind, so it's going to be fine.
Yeah, there you go. Done. What kind of research do you do? None.
Well,
we make a lot up.
Yeah, I mean, you do, of course, make a lot up. It is fiction. But a lot of reading. So we're sort of on top of a lot of that. We obviously don't read the kind of high-level scientific papers, although we have tried, but we can't understand them. So we read the more kind of popular books and follow the whole field. And we've also kind of met and spoken to a few experts. And it's really our sort of relationships with them that lead us to be relatively relaxed and optimistic, actually, about AI.
Really?
Yeah.
And what are those people saying, then?
Those people are saying what we are creating is going to be an incredibly advanced tool. Intelligence is a tool, and it can be applied. And if we can apply an artificial intelligence to some of the world's vastly complex and intractable problems, we may actually be able to get closer to solving them than ever before. To give you an example, one of the guys that we know is a guy called Demis Hassabis, who's the founder and CEO of DeepMind, an artificial intelligence company, a British one that was bought by Google for a lot of money, and he's always in the news because he's really at the forefront of the latest developments in AI. And one of the things that he did for Google was their huge data centers that use so much power, obviously, to kind of keep all the servers running. They'd already optimized the power usage there. He applied, and they thought nothing more could be done to further improve sort of energy economy. He applied one of his AI programs to it and saved them an extra 15%, saving them money, saving the environment, but also doing it in such a way that a human team of managers could never do, because it applies these kind of microscopic adjustments constantly. And that's just one sort of example of how an intelligence, not a consciousness, because I think people sort of conflate the two. Artificial consciousness is something else.
Yeah,
we deal with both in humans, but artificial intelligence just isn't conscious, doesn't have desires, doesn't have feelings, but can work problems out, is going to be hugely helpful for
us. So, but do you, because what your show proposes is that there is a link between artificial intelligence and consciousness, that at some point the next step is that, and whether that will mutate organically or someone will, you know, tweak the designs to make that happen. I mean, in a way, it's not so much droids coming to life and having, you know, self-awareness that frightens me. It's more, and this, I'm by the way, I'm stealing someone else's observation here when I say this, but like someone once said, imagine that, you know, we're using things like drones, and imagine we build an army out of robots who go in and kill. You don't have to make that moral decision anymore, because something else has to do it. So then it would be so much easier to press a button that says, right, go into that village and annihilate everyone. You know, there's... How can we be sure that this stuff won't be used for pure evil?
Well, that's true, but that's not really about artificial intelligence or consciousness. That's just about the advent of technology. You could argue that the very first time we invented a rifle, it put a distance between us and the act of killing. You know, we don't have to stab somebody. You're not a foot in front of them. You don't have to see their face, feel the blood gush over you. You've got a stick.
I like the idea that it's a really calm experience, you know, with a rifle. Especially back then when you had to load it and fix everything in and go, yeah, I've got absolutely no connection to what I'm doing here. But
that's it.
But on a fundamental level.
Has progressively removed us from the point of where our consequences, the consequences of what we do, take place. You know, so I mean, artillery pieces that you can bomb another town, you never see the town.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's been going on for 150, 200 years. So that's sort of a different issue in my book, is the degree of autonomy, I guess, that, you know, if what the difference is when the machine takes a decision to bomb or not bomb. That's but you know, we're not really there yet. I mean, it is a hugely thorny ethical issue.
But you, and certainly, in, I haven't seen series two yet, but you are tackling mostly with washing up, laundry.
The big issues
here, which I think is something everyone goes, wow, that would actually be pretty cool. But I once, in my days of doing stand-up and comedy songs, I wrote a rather immature but sort of... high concept song about what I call prostadroids, which would be one day we will. Do you deal with that at all? Like, you know, synths that are purely for sexual pleasure and yeah.
I mean, we sort of addressed that in series one, and it's sort of an ongoing sort of concept in our world. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think there's sort of interesting questions that we explored certainly in the first series about, you know, if there were machines that were unconscious, specifically designed for that, you know, is that better, you know, than having, you know, human sex workers?
Right.
Is that morally better?
Certainly people who are pressed into
of course,
against their will.
Or, you know, does the very fact that they exist encourage you? So is there some sort of, you know, moral degradation going on there anyway?
Is it cheating?
Well,
there you go. Is it cheating?
You know, what are the... can you still get an STD? You know, these are the other questions.
That would be an unusual feature to sort of fit into your...
Well, you still get viruses in computers, don't you? So, you know, there is something going on there. Good luck with the rest of the show.
Thanks very much.
With the rest of the series. I wondered if you had any favourite AI films or TV shows from before you started writing this work. Because there's actually been quite a few. Mm-hmm. And like I say, I mean, massive respect for like finding a way of telling this story. I was actually surprised. I went to see Ex Machina, which for ages I was saying Ex Machina, but they never say that in the film. So no one told me. I felt like a fool. But
just pronounce all films in the sort of Latin way.
Okay.
Yeah. Then you'll always sound clever.
Okay. Yeah. So how does that apply to Transformers?
Transformers. <Yeah.
laughs> I went to see it and I thought, well, this is like a tried and tested story and concept. But they, for my money, I thought they'd found a really fresh and original way of doing that. Are there any that for you when you were writing this? That you either were inspired by or had to avoid?
I think, you know, that we're sort of sci-fi fans, so we know there's a lot of films that have sort of been a big part of our, you know, film-going tutelage.
Nice word. I like that.
Thanks very much. I'm not sure it makes sense in that sentence, but I'm going to use it anyway.
It sounds nice, doesn't it?
So things like, I mean, Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Huge fan of Blade Runner.
The big one. How do you feel about the sequel?
Good.
If it's really good, then it'll be great.
You're not one of these, it's sacrilege, they shouldn't be doing a sequel to this.
No, because it might be really good.
Yeah, good.
What if it's really good?
Yeah. Well, the director's great, and you know, the people all involved seem to be great, so I'm optimistic.
Exactly, they're not going to delete the original Blade Runner and make that unavailable.
No, apparently they are.
They are.
That's the deal.
Right.
There wasn't enough hard drive space for both.
If we do a sequel to a really beloved film, I think we should insist that they delete the original as part of the contract.
That
would be a great press launch, wouldn't it? Just to really piss everyone off. We need the original Star Wars trilogy deleted in order to make this one.
Everybody needs to hand in their t-shirts and their figures.
They'll be burnt on a pyre.
Hand in, like at school. So we always get our guests to ask ask people to put forward a guilty pleasure, a film or TV show or anything really in the world of storytelling that you either know is terrible but you like anyway, or you think is misunderstood. Mm-hmm. You've both picked some really great choices. One of them is probably a first on this show, but
this is my one.
Okay, so why don't we start with the slightly more conventional but still brilliant choice, Jonathan? What did you go for?
I went for the film Howard the Duck. Which, or Howard, A New Breed of Hero, if you're going by the UK title.
Oh, was it really called that? Yeah. I don't remember.
Right. I don't know why they would change that. They're trying to sort of hide the fact it's about a duck.
Yeah.
They were just, no one will notice if we don't say in the title.
And
we
don't
just go in their droves. And,
and
like,
we
oh,
don't
it's
put the the main character on the poster. If we don't put that on there either, you know.
Yeah.
How, do you mind me asking how old you are-ish? Are you
63? No. I'm 37, he said, almost forgetting.
Because I'm old enough to remember that film, but it feels like not... If you weren't around when it came out, I just don't know why anyone would know that film, unless it's become a weird cult classic, but I don't think it has,
has
it?
Sort of... It's got a sort of cult following because it's so bad.
Why don't you describe it? Because I think it's
It's a film. It's based
George
on
Lucas.
George Lucas produced. Yeah. But I think it's actually technically it's the first Marvel film.
Seriously?
Because I think it's the first Marvel character adapted for a feature film. It's based on
the
comic.
That's why it took them so long to finally get other films made.
Exactly. So it's a comic from the 70s, and I didn't know the comic at all when I first saw the film. About a humanoid duck that comes to live on Earth. And I think the original comic is sort of a...
When you say humanoid, you mean...
Sorry, I should say in the film it's sort of humanoid kind of... It's
not
a
humanoid,
duck.
A human-sized...
Human-sized...
It's a duck.
A sentient duck.
Yeah, no, in the comic he's just a duck who can talk. Yeah. An intelligent duck who can talk.
But he's a robot duck in the film, is he?
He's not a robot duck. No, but essentially, it's a person dressed up as a duck in the film.
This sounds like the conversation George Lucas probably had when he was pitching this to and I'm the studio exec.
Yeah,
so,
hang on,
he's a robot duck.
The film is about Howard the duck, who comes from his home planet, which is a duck world, and comes to Earth and
meets Tim Robbins.
One of his early roles. Robbins and Lee Thompson.
Yeah.
And I remember. I think it came out in 1986 or so.
Yeah.
And I remember because I wouldn't have gone to see it at the cinema, but I remember our local news agent. You used to go to rent videos, VHSs back
on
in the day.
On
a little carousel.
Yeah, carousel. Yeah.
And I remember seeing it then. I think it was a 15 certificate, and I wasn't old enough.
What?
I thought I'm sure it is because it's got quite a lot of adult humour in it.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, wait a minute, this is a film about a duck, sort of a duck on Earth, but it's sort of for adults, and I was just fascinated.
Because he was sort of a bit of a wisecracking...
Yeah, he's a wisecracking...
He had his collar up, didn't he?
Bit of a pervert, you know.
Did he have a little mohawk as well?
He did, and there's a really weird joke in the film where he's got a condom in his wallet.
Oh my God,
that sort of instantly there is a mind, what the...
Mind you, it sort of sounds like a film that might work now. More than it did. Maybe it was so ahead of it. So just quickly, you've picked this as a guilty pleasure. Is that because you watch it regularly or you just...
I have a great fondness. I did genuinely like it as a kid. I genuinely thought it was great because it's so weird and fascinating. It's
I want to watch it.
Odd film.
I actually want to watch it.
It's sort of... it's essentially a kid's film with all this sort of mad adult humour in it. Obviously, if you watch it now, it's not a great film. That may come as a great shock.
And it was also famous for being such a huge flop as well.
It was one of the biggest flops of all the time.
Yeah. It was like Heaven's Gate
properly tanked.
Howard the Duck, then Waterworld.
Yeah. Although, obviously, Howard the Duck got his cameo back in, is it Guardians of the Galaxy?
There you go. Yeah,
he's back.
Our producer's nodding, very emphatically nodding.
He's in the collector's.
His head's almost coming off.
We are available to write the Howard the Duck reboot.
Yeah.
Are you though? Because you've got a lot of work on your hands, haven't you?
We'll find him.
We'll find it. All right.
You should get his name right for a start.
Blown it. You imagine if he was actually up for hiring you up until that moment. Yeah. That was the thing that blew it. Yeah. It was like, no, I'm never employing anyone who can't pronounce my name. Because he's a gangster from the
20s. That's what I've heard.
Don't mess with me. So that's a brilliant choice already. If it had just been that from you guys, I would have been giving you 5 stars from my strange rating system for Guilty Pleasures. Mm-hmm. And I urge everyone listening to go and track down Howard the Duck and watch it. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to rewatch it. I hope that is somewhere available. Sam,
Well, I really struggled to think of a Guilty Pleasure film. John reminded me that I really like the film Mission to Mars, but and also really like
the
Waterworld.
Brian De Palma one. Yeah. We had Waterworld only last week, actually.
But I don't feel like I can say that they're guilty pleasures. I would mount a spirited defence of them.
Good. I like that.
Any film graduate.
Good.
The thing that I do sort of feel sort of vaguely ashamed of spending a lot of time doing is watching poorly made top 5 mysteries videos on YouTube, of which there are thousands.
And are these made by who are these fan
made by various people? They are, you know, if you look at them, they'll have hundreds of millions of views, so there are a lot of people out there. They're just utter nonsense. I don't believe a single word of them, and yet I find them utterly compelling. So there'll be things like top 5 mysteries of World War II, like the Nazi gold train, and then there'll be a little kind of, you know, it's like a little sort of 10-minute documentary list format thing with kind of very ominous synth music all the way through and a really weird voiceover, like somebody with an inexplicable, unplaceable foreign accent or a sort of Bristolian accent. So it was one of the two.
Yeah.
Which may be the same thing. But and it's always nonsense, but or like top 5 people in history who disappeared inexplicably.
And are these made just by people at home, or are they made by actual production companies?
They are somewhere in between. They're made to a relatively high level, but they're not sort of just made by, you know, your dad on desktop publishing. They are.
I understand this as a guilty pleasure. Yeah. I found myself once, I think I was hungover just at home on my going down a YouTube wormhole and found myself, I'm so ashamed to say this, mm-hmm. watching clip collections of paparazzi hounding celebrities and scuffles and things happening. And
scuffles.
And there are so many of these fucking things. There are compilations that last 7 minutes and then there's celebrity paparazzi fights number one and then number two, and you're like, I can't believe how many of them.
I think I've watched a few of those in the past
and enjoyed them.
Bjork and Shia LaBeouf have a go, didn't they? They really get involved.
Alec Baldwin's got lots. Okay. He grabs them. He gets quite physical. Cool. So I think both of those things are brilliant guilty pleasures and 100% guilt. There's a lot of guilt in
Thanks very much.
So good job, guys. Good job. Well, look, thanks so much for coming on. Have you got anything after Humans coming up? Do you know if you're doing a third series yet? Or
we don't know yet.
No,
it'd be absolutely wonderful if we were able to. Mm-hmm. So fingers crossed.
Cool. Mm. If Kevin Feige's listening as well, you've got a Howard the Duck treatment ready.
We've settled on Feige. Then. Okay.
Feige. There you go. Yeah. You can see this Sunday nights, is that right? On Channel 4.
Sunday night, and Channel 4 at 9 o'clock.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, to play out the show, this isn't a song from a film or TV show, but just in keeping with the news this week, I thought I'd play a song from the band Death Cab for Cutie, one of my favourite bands. They released a song along with a lot of artists in the last month, I think, as protest songs, political protest songs. I think it's called 30 Songs for 30 Days, and they wrote this song especially. There's some great songs on that album. I think you can get it on iTunes. This is called Million Dollar Loan.
Green Eye is looking down on a city at night. From Gilded Room, from gold marble and soft perfume. He's proud to say the old-fashioned way.
This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details.